The ships HMS Erebus and Terror, led by Sir John Franklin, journeyed to the Arctic in 1845 to search for the fabled Northwest Passage. They were never heard from again. Now, while evidence has been discovered over the past 30 years as to what happened to the crew, the wreck of the Erebus remained a mystery until 2014 when the Canadian government announced its discovery and location. Michael Palin, member of Monty Python, playwright, train enthusiast, and travel documentarian, takes a look at this remarkable vessel, her adventures, and the mystery of the fabled Franklin expedition in his new book, Erebus, published by Random House Canada. And Michael Palin joins us in the studio. Good morning,
good
sir.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Now, this book is, with all the adventure and romance of its travels aside, this struck me as a very loving biography of a sailing vessel, almost like The Little Boat That Could.
Yes.
What attracted you to the story?
Well, really, precisely that. I was researching a completely different story about a man called Joseph Hooker, who was the director of the Botanical Gardens in London in the Victorian period. And I found out that at the age of 22, he'd signed up to go on a little ship called Erebus in 1839 down to the Antarctic. And they'd gone down there for 4 years. And, you know, the more I read about Hooker, the more I became interested in Erebus, the ship itself, and the fact it had done these extraordinary things. Just a sailing ship had gone further south than anyone had ever been in history, and it confirmed that the Antarctic was a continent, seen the ice shelf, all these wonders that they'd seen. I thought, why don't I know about this? You know, this is part of our history. But what I do know, of course, is that Erebus was later, after that very successful journey, chosen to be Franklin's flagship on the great attempt to go through the Northwest Passage, for the British to be the first to go through, and that was a complete disaster.
Yeah.
So I found this great story which of success, which no one knew about, followed by disaster, which a lot of people knew about. But it was, as you say, the discovery of the wreck of the ship under the water in 2014, that this little ship that was launched in 1826 was still there.
Mm-hmm. And relatively intact.
Timbers intact, yes. Yeah. That I said, well, this is a great story with an ending that isn't an ending. You know, it's all going off again. I have to say, John Cleese tweeted something yesterday. I thought it was very funny. He said, he was asked about my book, and he said, I've heard it. Michael's book is about a wreck, so I assume it's an autobiography.
But
I don't know why I should be giving John's funny lines out, but that was quite good.
Now, and this was really an age, I mean, the Napoleonic Wars were over, and Britain had this great sizable navy. This was really an age of navigational discovery, because they're loaning these ships out, saying, okay, you go here. Like, I didn't even know that the Erebus and the Terror went to the Antarctic. Like you, it was part of the story. I did not once, not twice, but three consecutive seasons.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
I know. And as you say, the thing was that the British Navy had no wars to fight, but it had a lot of expertise, and it had the ships, and it had the men. So they were kind of hiring themselves out. And it wasn't a purely British expedition. The German von Humboldt was behind the science. Another German wanted to know about the magnetic intensity of the Earth. All these very, very important things used the British Navy to sort of go and search for whatever they could find. So it was a very brief period when, without war and without glory, they were actually looking for how the Earth worked, you know, the science behind it. But it was a very brief period, because then, you know, war starts again and they start building battleships.
That's what happens.
That's what makes it kind of a rather inspiring period. It makes the Erebus a pretty inspiring little ship.
And I mean, it was basically a tub. It was like a bomb. They called it a bomb boat. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was designed as a warship, called a bomb ship, and they had strengthened hulls because they had two heavy mortars on board, and they would drag them around, find a little place that was under siege, and from the sea bombard it with very, very heavy cannonballs and lots of sort of fire and smoke, and generally terrify the residents.
Yes,
and then retire. So the ships were very functional, but they were strong. So they're basically strong, but they were slow, and they swung a bit in the storms, but they were basically very, very tough, which is why they were chosen.
It's the part that had me riveted and literally on the edge of my seat were some of the in the Antarctic, especially the close calls.
Yeah.
Holy, I mean, you had when if you were captaining or you were on those ships, You were a pretty gutsy person.
Yeah. Well, also, I mean, the men that actually saw the crew themselves who had to climb up the rigging and furl and unfurl sails in minus 30 degrees. Yeah. And they didn't use gloves at the time because they felt they had to, it would spoil their grip. So how they survived, and they did survive.
The majority of them did. Yeah, that's the amazing thing.
You know, there may have been a bit of frostbite, but there was no illness on board throughout those 4 years. It was a most extraordinary success. But, you know, the courage of people going somewhere where they had no charts, no maps, no one had been there ever.
Yeah.
It's like going into the unknown, which is a very exciting prospect.
Incredibly exciting. James Clark Ross, who captained the voyage to the Antarctic, when they got back and a couple of years later, they said, hey, do you want to lead the Arctic expedition into the Northwest Passage? Mm. He declined. He said, I had enough of this. Mm. So it ended up with the Erebus's, one of her original captains, John Franklin, as the leader. It strikes me, based on what I've read in your book, and he may not have been the best choice for this voyage.
He may not have been the best choice. We don't know, because we know so little about how the voyage sort of spun out. But we know that he was 59 years old. A lot of people were concerned that was far too old for someone taking on such a dangerous voyage. His wife, who was a very ambitious woman, sort of pushed him because he'd been disgraced as the sort of governor of Tasmania. That hadn't worked out. He'd been sent home, and she couldn't bear seeing her husband humiliated, so she pushed him forward. But you just don't know actually what part of the responsibility for the failure of the expedition was his. I mean, we know that he was alive 2 years after they set out from Greenland, and we know when he died. And he wasn't there at the very end. But he was experienced. But
he was also, I mean, in earlier expeditions, he led along the coastline of northern Canada.
Yes.
And he was such a stickler for detail that they almost all died.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was known by the British press as the man who ate his boots.
Yes, exactly.
Because he had sucked the leather on his boots to stay alive at some point. Well, this is what he wrote in his account of the journey, which was a very popular book at the time. One forgets, really, that these Arctic explorers were glamorous figures. They were rock stars of their time.
Astronauts of their
time. You know, They all came back, and the publishers rushed up and sort of offered them large amounts of money, and they all wrote their accounts of the journey. But he was the man who ate his boots, yes.
The term naturalist certainly had a different meaning back then than it does today. I mean, back then you basically shot everything that was different and sometimes even ate it.
Yes. Yes, there's all sorts of things like saw three emperor penguins on an ice floe, hit them on the head with my hammer and put them in the bag. You know, there was such a profusion of wildlife, and the balance was so different then. The wildlife was everywhere, very few humans around. So, and also that they were unable to photograph these exotic creatures. They were, you know, because of the weather and everything, they were unable to make little sketches. So they had to bring back sort of pelts and skins and bones and skeletons, just to tell people what they'd found. So in a sense, it was scientific, but they certainly, there was one guy aboard HMS Erebus who shot just about everything around.
It really is unbelievable. You've done exhaustive research for this book, not only looking at books written by some of the captains, but you've also gone obscure letters, diaries of ordinary seamen. Plus, in your travels with your documentaries, you must have touched on these places. How long did it take you to compile all this together?
Well, it took about 18 months, which is quite concentrated work. But I had to say no to all sorts of other things that were on the periphery. And I had to have a self-belief that I really wanted to tell this story, and it was a story worth telling. And in order to do that, I had to do my own research. I didn't have researchers. So I went to the archives myself. But I also travelled to some of the places like the Falkland Islands, Tasmania, the Northwest Passage, places which have been very, very important in the progress of the expedition, just to see what they felt like now. And also, you know, places like the Falkland Islands, a brilliant museum, and I got so much information from the people down there. And there's a kind of a network of people who love this period, and Erebus and Franklin and all that. And once you're in there, lots of people keep sending you bits of paper. Hey, did you know, here's something. I'm the great-great-granddaughter of the the cook on the HMS Terror.
That's fantastic.
Here's a letter. Great stuff. And it was the letters from the crew I love most of all, because the officers kept journals, rather serious journals, and had to be given to the Admiralty at the end of the journey.
Right.
But the crew just, with little letters home, and they would say disarming things about how they were feeling. Sometimes they were very unhappy, and they expressed these in their letters. So those are like gold dust.
You've had a very interesting career. I mean, you started out one of the greatest.
Sounds like an accusation.
Yeah. No.
I don't know how to defend myself.
I'm legitimately envious. You've been in one of the most famous comedy groups of all time. You've written plays. You've done some of the most entertaining travel documentaries I've ever seen. You're an author. What are you up to next?
I think I'm going to stop there.
Is that it?
I won't get any better than that. Yeah. Thank you very, very much. I don't know. I mean, I want to keep going. I feel reasonably fit, and I love working. I can't imagine retiring and sitting and watching TV all the time.
Right.
I just have to be out and about. And everything you do, you make friends, you make contacts. Someone suddenly get an email from someone you met 2 years before, and they say, oh, I've got an idea about so-and-so. What do you think? A lot of my life has been very, very good friendships, meeting people at the right time who've helped push me through and encourage me through. Because I'm actually, despite what you say, quite a lazy person.
I love
cafes and just having a drink and hanging out with people.
Wow.
But there have been other people with more urgent ambitions who've said, Michael, we've got to do this.
Wow. Before we let you go, because I know you're on a tight schedule, can I just say The Missionary is one of the most underrated films of all time?
Oh, that's very nice of you.
I love that movie.
Oh, good. Well,
that's great. Yeah, well, I want to thank
you so much.
I
just feel so much better for coming on your show.
Oh, well, God, I feel spectacular having you on the show. I want to thank you for coming in today, and thank you for writing this incredible book.
Good. Well, enjoy it, and hope your listeners will, too. I enjoyed writing it.
Good.
Well, there you go. And it shows. Ladies and gentlemen, we've been speaking with Michael Palin. Of course, film actor, Fish Called Wanda, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Who can't forget that? Monty Python author, travel documentarian. His new book, Erebus, One Ship, Two Epic Voyages, and the Greatest Naval Mystery of All Time, is published by Random House Canada. I urge you to run out to your local bookstore and pick up a copy.